What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Future-proof extra from News Talk.
Now, we all know that if you're left-brained, then you're analytical, or if you're right-brained, you're more artistic, except that you're not. It's a total myth. And the idea that art and science are somehow opposite ways of thinking to one another is another one. In reality, when it comes to the brain, art and science actually share quite a lot of similarities. So says my next guest. His name is Dr. Richard Roche. He's from Maynooth University's Department of Psychology and is the co-author of Why Science Needs Art. He was speaking on Thursday at First Fortnight's Mental Health Festival. Welcome to the program, Richard. Maybe we might start off talking about this idea that art and science are sort of opposite ways of thinking, you know, that logical thinking is the opposite way of thinking creatively.
Yeah, sure. There does seem to be a public perception that, you know, art and science are like polar opposites in lots of ways. And the stereotypes of artists and scientists are obviously very different and almost like, you know, mirror images of each other, where one is very analytical and, you know, procedural and disjointed from the work, whereas artists are more messy and more, you know, emotional and passionate and all these types of stereotypes. And
you sort know, of like Aristotle's logos and pathos.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the head and the heart kind of idea. But the reality is, you know, they share a lot of things. They share a lot in terms of the procedures that they use and the way they approach problems. There are a lot of similarities in terms of what they're trying to achieve, in terms of, you know, trying to communicate something, trying to understand and analyze the nature of a process or of an emotion or of a feeling or of a topic. And, you know, the history of it is really interesting, because there was a time when art and science were almost inseparable and really depended on each other. And, you know, you can think back to examples of people like Da Vinci, who is the classic example of someone who straddled both, because a lot of his anatomical investigations into the human body were heavily dependent on his drawings and his illustrations that he carried out. And, you know, the same is true for Galileo, for other people in areas like botany, and, you know, people like Maria Merian and Ellen Hutchins and Genevieve Jones, because for a long time, the only way scientists had to convey or to share their observations was to draw or to paint what they were seeing through the lens of a microscope or a telescope or whatever instrument they used. So, you know, this division or this separation of art and science is really more of a recent idea, because for a long time, they really did interact a lot and share a lot and inform each other.
When we talk about the brain, we talk about areas that were responsible for certain things, but we mean in general, they're sort of generalities, right? Because the way the brain works is it's a network of various regions. But do we find that the areas that we use when we are thinking critically are the same as those when we are trying to be creative and expressing ourselves?
Yeah, so as you say, you know, the brain is obviously, it's a whole, and it all operates in tandem with each other, with these other areas. But we do see particular areas that seem specialized for certain functions. And one of those is obviously the prefrontal cortex, which is the youngest in evolutionary terms, and which is really important for things like abstract thinking, abstract thought. And, you know, that's an important function when it comes to trying to create something, to be creative. So there are certain areas that seem critical for creativity. And there's some really interesting work from people who've suffered brain injuries or lesions or strokes to the left frontal area, where in maybe a rare number of cases, people who have damage to left frontal areas suddenly become artistic, where they've never been particularly creative or artistic before in their lives. They suddenly pick up a brush and start to produce a large volume of artwork. And it happens relatively commonly in frontotemporal dementia, where suddenly someone will become an artist almost overnight after brain injury.
Yeah, there's a great story about Bolero by Maurice Ravel, that there's a kind of a question about whether or not this insanely creative but very repetitive pattern in his music came from an acquired brain injury. As we see sometimes, as you say, some people painting the same thing over and over again after they have an accident. A really fascinating quirk that sometimes happens.
Yeah, no, I think what may be happening in those cases and the theory that people have suggested is that the area that's damaged normally exerts a sort of inhibitory function on other parts of the brain. So when that area becomes compromised or not functioning properly, then that inhibition is gone and people are more free, I suppose, or less inhibited to produce these creative pieces. So that's the current thinking on why this can happen, why suddenly somebody who was never particularly creative can suddenly have a burst of creativity after damage to that region.
When we look at these two things, when we try and understand science as not the creator but as an observer, whether we're looking at a painting or trying to understand someone else's work, are these different processes in the brain?
To an extent, I mean, there's an interesting overlap in terms of what happens in the brain when we look at artwork. So if we're exposed to artistic stimuli when we put in a scanner, we're in an MRI scanner, and people are shown pictures and paintings and famous pieces of art. We see activation in a network across the brain called the default mode network. Now, that involves a collection of different areas, places like the medial prefrontal, medial temporal, parts of cingulate and parietal cortices, and some of the emotion processing areas like the amygdala and the insula. And that network seems to be responsible for this feeling people get sometimes looking at art. They call it a sense of disinterested interest, this sort of like pleasant, faraway kind of feeling that people get.
And kind of like daydreaming.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's sort of a sense of like mind wandering, or sometimes memory kicks in and you can drift back to particular events in the past or particular feelings from the past. And it's interesting because that network is also implicated in autobiographical memory. So that sense of mental time travel, when we can go back in time to a specific day, a specific time, a specific event, and we can recall the sights and the sounds and the feelings and the smells of that very specific moment in time. So this ability that art has to sort of transport us back seems to be due to this overlap in those brain networks, this default mode network that kicks in the brain.
You're interested in a field that I haven't heard before. It's called neuroaesthetics. What exactly is this discipline, and what are you hoping to explore?
Yeah, so this is an area that in some ways it's relatively new, because it's only taken off in the last few decades since brain imaging technology has really improved. But it actually goes back to the earliest experimental psychologists. So people like Wilhelm Wundt and Gustav Fechner back in the 1890s in Germany. And it's really the study of how we process things that we consider aesthetically interesting or aesthetically beautiful. Mm. Now, there's a whole area within philosophy on aesthetics that looks at the nature of beauty, and that's a whole other sort of parallel thing. But neuroaesthetics is really trying to use the tools and the techniques of neuroscience, like functional brain imaging, to study what happens when we respond to visual stimuli that are considered aesthetically interesting or artistic or somehow pleasing to look at. So it's work in neuroaesthetics that's led us to discover these patterns of results to do with the default mode network. And it also allows us to identify features of stimuli, features of paintings or pieces of art that the brain finds particularly engaging or kind of draws the brain's attention to them.
So essentially, this neuroaesthetics discipline is trying to figure out what happens when someone sees something that they like aesthetically.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, to look at things that are considered aesthetically pleasing. But the flip side is that the brain also seems to find particular interest in things that it doesn't like, things that might be considered ugly or grotesque or horrible. And that also seems to be particularly attractive to the brain. It sort of grabs the brain's attention.
is the idea to understand why these things provoke feelings in us, or what the purpose of these feelings, what is the purpose of finding something you like?
That's one of the controversial aspects around neuroaesthetics, I suppose, because a lot of people have objected to the whole discipline in the sense that they feel to pick apart and to reduce and to analyze the experience of aesthetics and the experience of, you know, appreciating art is to somehow diminish it. And, you know, I'm of the opposite opinion, that to understand what happens in the brain when we're appreciating art actually enhances our experience of it.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, you know, the person who, some people love to know how a magic trick works, and it just enriches the experience for them to know the mechanics of the trick, whereas other people prefer to live with the mystery and to not know how it happens. So it's a bit similar to that, maybe.
It is really interesting, because it seems like a difficult thing to grasp why we like certain things and what's happening in the brain. There's a wonderful story that I heard in the 99% Invisible podcast about a 31-year-old painter named Gerard van Bladeren, who went to the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam. And he saw this painting by Barnett Newman. It was called Who's Afraid of Red, Yellow and Blue 3? And essentially, it's just a large letterbox painting of red with a thin blue stripe along the left-hand side. It's an abstract painting of a red rectangle with a thin blue line along the side. And Van Bladeren looked at this painting over a number of times and got so angry and so upset at the painting. He was a painter himself, that he went in and he destroyed the painting. He tore it down and destroyed it, hacked it to pieces with a box cutter, because he hated it so much. It caused such feelings of fear and hate in him that he was just compelled to destroy it. And that is fascinating to me, that we can feel this way about art. We just bought a painting at Christmas and we love looking at it. But I don't know what it is about it that I love. I mean, the colors, sure, it's abstract, so it's not what it represents necessarily. But that to me is fascinating, why some things are beautiful, why some things are not, and how some things can remain classically beautiful for millennia and others change over time. Is that of interest to scientists?
Yeah, it's sort of at the core of neuroaesthetics. One of the things people have tried to do, Ramachandran is one of the big people in neuroaesthetics, and he's identified, he calls them his 12 laws of neuroaesthetics. And they're kind of principles of the stimuli. Now, the emotional aspect is a totally the other side of it, because things, you know, arise within us. These emotional responses arise within us in response to art. But there are principles of perception, certain features that the brain really likes. One of them that I mentioned is to do with, you know, things that are incomplete, and the brain loves to complete something that's not finished. But there are other principles to do with how stimuli are arranged, or how color is used, or how things are placed on the page. Things like exaggeration, which you know, we can see examples of with caricature. They're interesting because they grab the brain's attention due to the fact that they violate certain rules, or they adhere to particular perceptual principles that we know from studies of perception. The fact that the brain likes things that are continuous, that the brain tends to like closure. So we'll prefer, or we'll almost automatically perceive a sort of a circle with a wedge missing rather than a Pac-Man shape. So we have these biological patterns that remarkably artists have somehow tapped into intuitively over the centuries, and understanding those principles and observing how they're used in paintings really enriches the experience for me when you look at something that's, you know, considered a masterpiece, because these artists have somehow grasped these principles without understanding the brain at all, without understanding perception, but they've applied them in their work. And those are some of the reasons that we're drawn to these images.
Yeah, I must have a think next time I'm looking at a painting that really draws my eye, that I would love to own. I must think, what is it about that? I think I really struggle. Dr. Richard Roach from Maynooth University, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Jonathan. Bye.